Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. After days of speculation, the political transition in Uzbekistan coming to an end, and we are entering to a Shavkat Mirziyoyev era who succeeded Karimov in violation of the constitution. While doing so, Mirziyoyev copied the model which was tested 10 years ago in Turkmenistan during the transition of power from Niyazov to Berdimuhamedov, who has this week scrapped all the legal barriers on his way to a lifetime presidency. Though still unclear, but with changes in Uzbekistan, we have also seen unprecedented government reshuffles in Kazakhstan, in which president's daughter increasingly coming closer to succeed her father. All these government shakeup raises question whether the Turkmenistan-style political transition is becoming a new model for Central Asia, and what does it mean about the future of the region and hopes for democratic changes. In this episode of Majlis, we will discuss these subjects in details, draw a comparison between various transition of power in Central Asia, connect the dots between ongoing constitutional amendments and government reshuffles to the struggle of succession. To discuss the subject, I have Dr. Lukan Cheshi, Chair of the Central Asian Studies Center at the University of Glasgow in UK. Welcome, Dr. Lukan, to the show.
Hello, Mohammed.
Very nice to have you. Erika Marat, Assistant Professor of International Relations at the National Defense University, is joining us from Washington, D.C., who is originally from Kyrgyzstan. Welcome, Erika, to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Bakhtyor Nishanov, Deputy Director of Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, is joining us from Washington, D.C., who is originally from Uzbekistan. And Bruce Panier, Editor at the Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is joining us. Bruce, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Bruce, are we done with the political transition thing in Uzbekistan?
There still might need to be a little shuffling at lower levels, but I think it's fair to assume that Shavkat Mirziyoyev is headed to be the next elected president of Uzbekistan when they do hold elections. He seems to at least temporarily have sorted things out with Rustam Azimov. You know, we've done podcasts before and mentioned that they were both potential successors for Karimov, and it looks like I said, for now anyway. My understanding from looking at reports is that they've kind of worked out any differences they had, and they're both maintaining, you know, Mirziyoyev's technically still prime minister and acting president, and Azimov was confirmed as finance minister. So I don't see any changes coming.
Bakhtyor, any clue about the upcoming election, which Shavkat Mirziyoyev has legally to hold in 3 months?
You know, quote unquote elections on December 4th. At this point, unfortunately, I have to say it's my conviction that, you know, we probably all know the results, and we know who the next president of Uzbekistan is going to be. And just like Bruce said, at this point, I mean, the transition has been so smooth that it raises a lot of questions. You know, I hear a lot of people come up to me, and people who know that I'm originally from Uzbekistan or work on Eurasia, coming up to me and saying, well, look, it's better than some other countries in the Middle East, where you see these, you know, bloody, you know, transitions, and this has been so good, so smooth, it's good for the people of Uzbekistan. You know, to which my answer is, I just do not think this transition and the sense of, you know, tranquility that we currently have in Uzbekistan is real. I do believe that unless the governments of these countries, in particular, since we're talking about Uzbekistan, they, you know, carry out real reform, I do believe that they will have major problems down the line. Just a very quick note on Bruce's point, I 100% agree that, you know, at this point it seems like, Azimov and Mirziyoyev worked out their differences. A couple of things that to note, though. You know, you probably noticed that Abdullah Aripov, who had been previously a minister, was brought back. This is a guy who's been dismissed on corruption charges, and that's somewhat of a surprise that he was brought back. And again, you know, somebody who there's been a criminal case against him. The other thing is Rustam Azimov's portfolio has been increased, and with increased responsibility, responsibility, I would not be surprised if this is some kind of a medium to longer term I hate to use this word, but game, you know, these seemingly innocuous changes in a government may indicate where the government is heading post-election.
Dr. Luca, restatement of the Aripov, does it say anything about the possibility of Shavkat Mirziyoyev reversing some of the Karimov's policies?
These are always the big questions that we hear when, you know, this president die and someone new comes in. Is there going to be change? Turkmenistan, where in the first few months after Niyazov died and Berdi Muhammadov coming in as interim and then the election in February, everyone was saying, oh, it's opening up, it's changing new policies. And then look at where we are now, 10 years down the track, having a constitution which puts him in charge for pretty much his own life. So, no, I don't think that we can be optimistic about any kind of policy change. What we've seen is a leadership change happen according to the constitution. Doesn't really mean that it's going to be a better way of governance, because the constitution itself is authoritarian by design. Central Asia, we got these constitutional drafts of the early 90s, which in most cases were highly presidential, so they facilitated creating these authoritarian regimes. And then they've been amended with authoritarian agendas in mind, and that entrenched even further authoritarian politics. So what we've seen is different from the prior one, just because he is younger, operating within the same system, within the same rules. So I can see why we're going to have different policies.
Thank you, Dr. Luca. It was nice that you mentioned Turkmenistan. This brings us to our next topic. Erica, how similar or different has been so far the political transition of Uzbekistan to what we have seen in Turkmenistan 10 years ago?
I mean, there is the point to make that they have been similar, that it's been behind the scenes, and that it was very well planned. But I wouldn't go as far as to say that this is the Central Asian tendency to transfer power like this. When we look at Kazakhstan, I think the power transition is going to be different because in Kazakhstan, just the structure of the state and political elites is different. And there is more competition and there is more bureaucracy in a good sense of it. So even if the current leader, the transition is still going to have a different flavor to it. I think maybe even, you know, elections are going to be a little more fair and transparent compared to what we will see in Uzbekistan in December. And there's just going to be a little more debate and discussion about what's happening, as opposed to in Uzbekistan right now is just pure coronation and no discussion whatsoever.
Definitely. I do see there is a little bit different approach is visible there. But coming back to Turkmenistan, Bruce, I cannot avoid mentioning the constitutional change this week, which paves the way for current Turkmen president a lifetime opportunity to remain in power, although it might have been planned earlier. But the timing of this change also suspiciously coming together with other changes in the region. Where this constitutional change in Turkmenistan is taking us?
Well, I think everyone assumed from the start that he'd get around to something that would keep him on in power for quite a long time. The time is only interesting in so much, I would say, as it's coincidental with all the other stuff that's been going on. We've known since February that this was coming in Turkmenistan. We just didn't know exactly when it was going to happen. So they seem to have slipped it in yesterday real fast. It's hard to say this is optimistic, but at least I would add that they did decide that it was necessary to amend the constitution to put this kind of change in there, as opposed to Berdi Muhammadov's predecessor, Safarmurat Niyazov. The elders' council suggested that he just remain on as leader for life, and that wasn't written into the constitution or anything. And they just voted on that and went for that, and that's what kept Niyazov in power all that time. So, you know, for what it's worth, at least there has been a constitutional change now that allows Berdi Muhammadov to run for office as many times as he wants and stay as long as he's alive. So,
Bakhti, I remember that we have had some exchange going back and forth on this. Mirziyoyev will be any different than Berdimuhamedov in his actions, in his deeds, in his style or politics or policies?
I would very, very much hope so. The one thing going for Berdimuhamedov is that, you know, he's at least a little bit more entertaining than I think Shavkat Mirziyoyev is going to be. You know, he rides horses, he sings songs, he's on television, you know, hosting, New Year's Eve and that kind of stuff. You know, I think with Shavkat Mirziyoyev, and I say it with all responsibility, is overall, I do think the situation is going to be worse. Because the thing is, I think with Karimov is, at the very least, with Karimov, you had a situation where, you know, early on, he did very much care about, you know, what the West thought, what, you know, the U.S. thought. I mean, he was very much kind of, you know, trying to promote some of these ideals, at least lip service. You know, again, from day one, we're talking about Shavkat Mirziyoyev taking over, and so on and so forth. But honestly, even to, I think, people who were watching this very closely, the way they just dealt with the Constitution, and again, the irony of it all, the Constitution was specifically amended to prevent this kind of power grab, right? To prevent this kind of, you know, the prime minister just kind of coming in and just taking over. That the point was that a member of the parliament takes on the responsibilities of acting president. The way they just complete disregard for the Constitution, this is very much along the lines of what Bruce was saying about Berdimuhamedov. At the very least, with Karimov, you know, there was this effort to dress it up, to make it part of a constitutional process, right? I mean, yes, we know how it was done. Yes, we know how people voted and why people voted for it the way they did. But the bottom line is, at least there was some kind of, you know, let's pretend that this is a process. With Shavkat Mirziyoyev, I think even that pretend this is a process thing is just going to go away.
You are scaring us, Bakhti.
I'm scaring myself, honestly.
Just a follow-up on this. What do we know about Mirziyoyev's family?
Mirziyoyev's family is, at this point, it's pretty much open. It wasn't even a secret from the get-go, but, you know, I did go to school with his daughter back in early 2000s. And let me put it this way. She did not necessarily impress me as somebody who comes from a family where, you know, the values of respect and towards your elders is very, very strong, that it did not impress me as there was a whole lot of that kind of values in her. And, you know, it's very much, again, you know, this is very stereotypical, but, you know, Central Asia, unfortunately or fortunately, you can pretty much tell about a family just looking at their kids, and not the best impression, let me put it this way, right? She is, you know, there was a profile in the Guardian about her lifestyle and, you know, her daughter wearing this little girl, literally like 5 year, you know, 3-4 year old girl wearing, you know, $5,000, you know, dresses. You know, this is very much indicative of what's going on in Uzbekistan, right? Where you have this complete and utter economic downturn, where the state-run economy is absolutely failing. And you have these, you know, for lack of better words, rich kids of Uzbekistan just showing off on Instagrams. And so definitely you can find out more about them than you could about, you know, in the past. But that said, it's pretty insular. I obviously don't keep in touch. I don't think they would want to keep in touch with me with the kids who I went to, you know, college with. But I would assume it's still very lavish, you know, lifestyles, not completely unjustified in the sense of, you know, what they can themselves afford.
I was just wondering, with the size of his family, I mean, number of his sons, daughters.
The daughter, 100%, she exists. You know, and again, the niece is the connection. The importance of the niece is she is the widow of the nephew of Alisher Usmanov, right? Mm-hmm. And Alisher Usmanov is one of the richest people in Russia who's got connection to the Kremlin. So, but as to the, you know, to the rest of the family, I know. I just don't know.
Okay. Dr. Luka, the way the political transition took place in Uzbekistan also raises some question about the model. Popular predictions about future of current leaders in Central Asia were the continuation of a family dynasty, but earlier in Turkmenistan, now in Uzbekistan, they are changing the game of throne, let's say. What's causing to this, or the popular prediction was wrong?
I think it was wrong from the beginning. I never seen any kind of dynasty working in these systems, however sophisticated, wide, or cohesive the elites around the presidents might be. Of course, strange family, in the case of Karimov, we've got, I mean, the daughters are controversial in different ways, but ultimately both controversial. And in Kazakhstan, there is not a male sort of male heir to the president. So the only chance for those who wanted to have dynasty are confined to Rahmon, as far as I understand. But that's for another day. I never believed that we would have sort of Azerbaijan sort of process. I somehow believe that we would have, you know, what Nazarbayev liked to think, the Singapore model, in which the president appoints someone, but that disappeared in the Uzbek case. Now, the big question, for me, the Uzbek case and the Turkmenistan transition are relatively similar. I got Erika's point that there are differences, there are, but ultimately they moved according to some similar patterns. Again, I don't think that there is dynasty going on. For me, Darga is there for other reasons, not for political reasons. But that's the one to watch, even because that would be the real end of an era. When Nazarbayev goes, the last or the first president will be gone, and that would be the real change of game in the region.
Erika, any idea? Definitely, we are going to talk about Kazakhstan in the second half of the program, but just to get this out from our way, I mean, any idea about the shape that the transition is taking place in Kazakhstan? Is it closer to Turkmenistan? Is it a family dynasty? What is that?
No. My original point was that it's going to be a more dynamic process, and I completely agree with Luca saying that Tajikistan is the only contender for a dynastic rule transition, power transfer, and the son is groomed to possibly become the next leader, though the current leader, Rahmon, seems to be young, relatively, and healthy. But in Kazakhstan, I think they're political elites, but they're also economic elites. They represent economic elites. And whoever succeeds Nazarbayev, I think his family doesn't want to end up like Karimov's family, who seems to be just like Bruce wrote in his excellent piece. Kind of now, you know, they are not in the forefront of political life, and their economic fortunes might be challenged as well in the coming years. So I think will at least inherit a better deal once Nazarbayev is gone.
Can I jump in with just one thing? Because before, I know we're going to leave to Kazakhstan, and I just wanted to say one thing about the Turkmen and Uzbek transition processes was that, you know, this might actually be a base plate for a lot of this stuff. When the leaders died in both those countries, the news of their deaths was suppressed as much as possible. I mean, we're not 100% sure with Niyazov, but it seems like he'd actually been dead for several days. And deciding what the next move is going to be before they make the announcement of death. And that's why we have what appears to be a smooth transition, is because this has been, you know, probably round-the-clock meetings practically over the course of several days before they come out with their own story and you know, who's going to be in charge of the country. And in both those cases, of course, they circumvented the Constitution. Both Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan were supposed to have the Speaker, a chairman, as the interim president. And in both cases, that was thrown out. In Turkmenistan's case, it was the Senate chairman was arrested and he was put out of the picture. And in the Uzbek case, we had a more theatrical performance where the chairman of the Senate came and said he just didn't think he was qualified, and he preferred that someone like Mirziyoyev, who was respected among the population and everything, would take over. Now, there might be some elements of that we'll see repeated in all these countries, if something like Kyrgyzstan being an exception always.
We will talk more about Kazakhstan in the second half of the debate, but let's get Kyrgyzstan out of our way. Erika, the timing of the ongoing efforts on constitutional amendments is very suspicious in Kyrgyzstan. Does it have anything to do with the future of Atambayev or his family or his regime?
Yeah, that's really unfortunate what we see in Kyrgyzstan today, and Atambayev basically doing the same thing that his predecessor did, try to change constitution and present it as if this was the will of the people. It's very unfortunate because Kyrgyzstan now falls into the same pattern as we see across former Soviet states, that once the incumbent, possibly democratically elected, which Atambayev is, once his tenure is about to end, then he becomes more authoritarian in order to suppress competition before the next elections. And Atambayev can't run for another presidential term, but it seems like he's preparing this ground for himself with the constitutional changes as a prime minister or some other high-ranking political position. Again, it's very unfortunate to see him undermining all the achievements in establishing a dynamic political process that have been made by Roza Atambayeva, by some members of parliament in the aftermath of regime change in 2010.
Are we talking about possibility of Kyrgyzstan joining other Central Asian countries?
So I don't think Kyrgyzstan at this point will be as autocratic as neighboring countries. It's just impossible to reverse the process at this point of dynamic civil society and independent media. But there is always space for more authoritarianism, more centralization of power, more corruption, and that. These tendencies might actually destabilize the country in the future.
Well, thank you, Erica Merritt. Just to recap the discussion today in the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, we are talking about model of political transition in Central Asia in light of Mirziyoyev's move to succeed Karimov in Uzbekistan. Discussing the subject with me are Dr. Lukan Cheschi, who is the chair of Central Asian Studies at the University of Glasgow, Erica Merritt, Assistant Professor of International Relations at the National Defense University, Bakhtiyor Nishanov, Deputy Director for Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia Blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Now, first, let's update Bruce ourselves on Kazakhstan. There has been lots of political changes in recent days as authorities wouldn't explain the reason. The rumors have been that those changes have to do with what is going on in Uzbekistan lately. What is your take on that?
Well, of course, a lot of it was just shifting people around. But, Prime Minister Masimov was moved over to be the head of the security service. There's various explanations for that. Some people say that is the Zhumakhanov, who had been in there since last December, had done a bad job responding to some of these so-called terrorist incidents that they had in Kazakhstan during the last few months. I'm more willing to believe that the Karimov's death probably had an effect on Nazarbayev's decision making. So he trusted allies in a lot of cases for many, many years. Into the key positions that he thought they should be in the event of a succession sometime or another. And we'll talk about why the timing, I'm sure, later. But essentially, he moved, he kept the people that he really trusted. He moved some of them over into different positions. A lot of people would agree, or at least say, that being head of security, the security service in Kazakhstan, is a more powerful position than prime minister, at least in so much as you've got your hands on a great deal of information about, if you want to look at it this way, he would be the guarantor that the system would be preserved, and that no one, if Nazarbayev for some reason was unable to serve as president or decided to leave office, he would be the one that would keep control over the whole country so that things wouldn't fall apart and so Nazarbayev's family wouldn't suffer. And really top officials would keep their own position. So that's one thing. Now Sagantayev is always interesting, and he started showing up in the media regularly.
We are talking about the guy who's the prime minister.
Yes, Bakhitjan Sagantayev is now the new prime minister of Kazakhstan. And, I've been having conversations with people about how would you know if the succession was coming and who would be a successor. And I'm not suggesting necessarily that it's Sagantayev, but we kind of agreed that it would be someone that we didn't see very clearly, but who would suddenly start climbing the ladder through the government rapidly. And Sagan Tayev has kind of followed that pattern. Like I said, we didn't hear a whole lot about him until a year ago, and certainly as of January this year, he started appearing, and commenting on key issues that had to do with the government, and that was well publicized in Kazakhstan too, so that he got a great deal of press time on a range of issues: energy, security, agriculture, all kinds of stuff. So you could see that someone was trying to get the population familiar with who he was. In anticipation of the day when he would actually be lifted up a little bit higher than he was. And for whatever reason, apparently the day has come that they decided to put him up there. We still haven't seen any of his decision-making ability, but certainly he was someone that was telegraphed as being, headed toward the top. Taslim Gambetov, of course, he's deputy prime minister again. He's been there forever. He was the defense minister, but he's been around for so long in Kazakhstan's politics that's hardly a surprise. And then, of course, Dariga got moved over to back into the Senate, which is essentially the same hierarchy as Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan constitutionally are, where the chairman of the Senate is the one that takes over in the event the president is unable to perform their duties or dies.
Hmm. Dr. Luka, one question which is kind of, I'm dwelling from the morning, so we don't have much information why this might be happening in Kazakhstan, but why Nazarbayev is moving so fast in these changes?
I can only speculate.
Right.
The timing for me is the most evident indicator of the connection.
Right.
How long do we have? A week between the funeral and the reshuffle or something like that. So they connected. It's not just life and death, it's also power and outside of power. So seeing what happens over there in Uzbekistan, considering that Nazarbayev, it's only a 2 year younger than Karim was born in 1940, it must have some impact on his way of seeing the future, mustn't it? So, again, it's just speculation. And we also have a perception. It can be only a perception, but it's a perception nonetheless of an orderly transition in Uzbekistan is something which is emerging more strongly even on Kazakhstani media. The fact that government sources, even think tanks, now acknowledge the fact that transition worked. It seemed to portray the idea that the possibility of having something pre-organized and orderly could be working there as well. This is elite level. Already two or three years ago, intellectuals, non-aligned, of course, were talking about what kind of succession process should be, election, namely, versus just a coronation.
Huh.
But the elite is the key actor in this context. So I would not be surprised if there was a design between this reshuffle and putting Sagan Tayev as prime minister. I don't agree with those who think that Maximov has been demoted. For me, it just has been shifted on an equally important position because his power probably is not very representative because of ethnic constraints, but is real. So in that sense, what we've seen, at least on the surface, that we'll never know, we see the replication in Kazakhstan of a sort of diarchy, which we've seen already in 2006 in Turkmenistan and now in Uzbekistan, with a man, strong men in terms of Kenebey, in terms of security services that can support him. So for me, that's the Central Asia model in general terms. Having someone who can be accepted, and I know that Mirziyoyev is boring, but so must have been Nazarbayev in 86 and Karimov in 89, technocrats. This could work. And then, on the other hand, their power doesn't really sustain itself unless there is the support of the security services, which we know in the region are really strong. To connect the dots between what happened in Uzbekistan and what we've seen in Kazakhstan, I would not exclude that what we're seeing could be the beginning of a transition. I'm not saying, and I agree with Bruce here, that it will be Sagan Tayev. But what we've seen is the instigation of a process in which, that could last a month, 3 months, 10 years. But it's a process nonetheless.
Erika, a beginning of transition in Kazakhstan?
Well, essentially, we don't know. But yeah, it seems like things are getting organized before a possible transition. That's for sure. I mean, I think Nazarbayev and the government allowing some debate on what Kazakhstan is going to look like after him is trying to make sure that the transition goes smoothly. But as Luca said, he prefers, or his family or his loyalists prefer to see, but the person has to be accepted by the population.
If that is a criteria, then Dariga, her move to Senate is a huge thing. And according to Interfax, some officials are already talking about her potential appointment as a chairperson of the Senate. So what is taking place with Dariga these days? Erika, would you like to continue?
I don't think that she has any chance of succeeding her father, but she will be a prominent figure. There is no question about it.
Bakhti, I also would like to draw some comparison here with the situation in Uzbekistan when Gulnara Karimova was seriously talked about as a potential successor to Karimov a few years ago. Now, Dariga being viewed by some people in the same manner. What are the similarities and contradictions between Dariga and Gulnara in this context?
I know it sounds weird, but Kazakhstan is a much freer society in Central Asia compared to, well, aside from Kyrgyzstan, compared to the others. So I do think the acceptance of people is very important. The one thing to note about, you know, Gulnara Karimova in Uzbekistan, I think this is a factor that a lot of people overlook, and something that, you know, gives me a little bit of hope about Uzbekistan is, you know, she was absolutely not accepted by people of Uzbekistan. But, you know, people did accept, you know, Karimov as the father of the nation, this and that, you know, brought independence and this and that. So, you know, yes, you know, there are here and there, you know, he may not make a whole lot of sense, and these policies may not make a whole lot of sense. But, you know, he's a good guy. He's trying to do his best. But, you know, his kids, when you're in Uzbekistan, rumors of Gulnara Karimova, you know, taking this business over, taking that business over, you know, leaving people jobless, doing this and that. I mean, they were constant. And this, we talk about police state, but despite that, some of these, I'm 100% sure, were not true. Some of them probably based on some truth. But the bottom line is, you know, the acceptance levels for Gulnara Karimova were just not there among the elites, but also among the population. Probably as somebody who was born in Uzbekistan and as an ethnic Uzbek, I can say this, you know, Uzbek people are seen as sheep, right? As this, you know, you lead them somewhere, they go. And, you know, they just every now and then there's going to be one who's going to say something. But the bottom line is, all in all, they're very quiet, very meek people. So they're not going to do anything. I just would not be so sure all these things that Shavkat Mirziyoyev is pushing through, they're going to catch up. How shall I say? Unorthodox ways he may govern may not be as high as for Karimov. And that's a very important thing. Just a very quick note on that. I mean, I don't know if you saw, but the government is trying to explain away the constitutional, right? The constitution there being appointed acting president is not a violation of constitution. Obviously, they are seeing that people are talking about these things, or the effort to squash the rumors about the date of Karimov's passing too, right? They are very publicly going after these people. The point being that, you know, people are talking about it. People are questioning some of the things. So, again, like I said, you know, I do hope that, you know, some of the cooler heads in Uzbekistan's government will prevail, and they will see that, you know, way of doing things is just not going to work long.
Thank you, Berti. So coming back to Kazakhstan, Dr. Lucas, we have seen Masimov going to different positions. Then you got the Sargentayev and Tash Magomedov coming to a new position. So what is the prediction about his next move?
Well, in Kazakhstan, beyond the popular sort of support, which we conclude is very important, the elite is more sophisticated, so there will have to be agreement also within the elite about whoever comes later. And also the first family, so Nazarbayev, Dariga, and so on, they have substantive economic interests. Huh. So I see Dariga staying on because she will be the guarantee of Nazarbayev keeping the family, keeping their business wealth sort of untouched. The next move, I think that whatever happened in Uzbekistan had an impact on the president. So whether or not he will return to his Singapore dream, in which he clearly appoints someone publicly, and you know, and it's Bruce, I'm sure, agrees, the first president-in-law really allows him to stay in power without really being in power. And they probably just keep going with this agreement until he actually dies. But again, I'm speculating. I mean, I think that we have to agree that when Nazarbayev goes, it's the end of an era. And all the things, all the parameters that we used to think about the region, of course, the exception of Kyrgyzstan, for 25 years, will have to change. So they will let there be some new analysis, they will let there be new scholarship about the region, but there also will be a time in which change will have to be understood correctly. But just to recap, Mohammed, I think, and on this, I'm happy to go on the record, that I think that what we've seen last week is the beginning of the transition.
Huh. Bruce,
you know, if I could
Bruce,
just jump in.
Yeah, like, we've been talking about this. He's already 76, right? And yes. Nazarbayev. So when this, the transition that we are talking about, when realistically it might happen?
Let's also remember that the reason that they're kind of vaguely giving for why they had to do this reshuffle is because they got to tackle the current crises that Kazakhstan is facing right now. And this comes after they just had to reshuffle the government after parliamentary elections earlier this year. So, I can't possibly buy this. It either you don't believe what they said or you have to think that the problem is so much worse than it was that they keep having to move people around the government. But I really think this is the transition team that he stuck in there, which means that you can't put these people in now and expect all of them, your transition team, to stay in power for 10 years until you finally pass away or something, because typically when things go wrong in the country, you blame the government and you start reshuffling officials and appointing new ones. So if these are really the people that he wants to be there when he's deciding to go, then we have to consider that there's probably some kind of deadline that he's set for himself. We've talked a lot about the big officials that have done that were, you know, replaced, shuffled around and stuff like that. But what I found really interesting about this most recent shuffling around of officials a couple of days ago, he decided to replace the head of the Central Election Commission. And that's something that usually happens aside from ministerial shuffles and government shuffles and stuff like that. But it was very interesting to me that it was almost like there was a plan of like who goes where and what gets changed when we get the transition team in. And for some reason, the Central Election Commission chairman was one of the people that was also changed at the same time, which you could speculate for all day about what that means exactly. But I would consider that these people that he's got now are basically the core. There might be other people that he still wants to get into certain positions, but this is probably the people that he wants in place in the event that there is a transfer of the presidency to somebody else.
And just one very quick thing, Mohammed, and they're not extremely young either. These people are not in their 30s or 40s, which means that the alliance that Nazarbayev think of are longer term than having someone more young, sort of younger, emerging now. So I think the generational factor is also to consider. That's why I agree with Bruce.
We are talking really about transition here and also very precise information, except the deadline is missing. What is your take on that? And second, what role do you see Nazarbayev family playing or Nazarbayev himself playing in the future in Kazakhstan?
Well, it's I've been teaching Central Asia, course in Central Asia, various compilations of it since 2006. And I was saying to my students since then that about, you know, any time now we might see change. So we can't really have a deadline. But yeah, Nazarbayev, I think Nazarbayev's legacy in general is going to be much more positively remembered in Kazakhstan. He's an autocrat, but he's a different type of autocrat compared to Karimov or Berdimuhamedov or any other autocrat, even, you know, in the former Soviet space. He's fairly popular. Of course, there are pockets of strong opposition and there are grievances in Kazakhstan society, but still, he is he's quite popular. He's a popular autocrat. So his legacy will be a lot more positive compared to Karimov. Let me just mention something else that I think we're not really considering yet in the context of Central Asia, but I think at least from my perspective, and, you know, I teach at a military college, and maybe I'm influenced by that. But I think the change change towards more open societies and more democracy is not going to come through those planned successions, but it's really going to come from bottom-up resistance. And that this bottom-up resistance might be violent. And again, this is speculations, but unfortunately, you know, to put it bluntly, I think there will be violence before there'll be real political change in Central Asia.
Okay, thank you, Erica.
I don't want to end this conversation on this note, but
anyone who would like to put a positive note in this discussion, then go on.
If I just may, I
positive, Bakhti, please.
I thought it was going to be. I 100% agree with Erica, but here's the thing, right? I mean, look, especially in Kazakhstan, This is the thing that I was talking about earlier about Uzbekistan. You know, when we talk about smooth transitions, what we are not really talking about are these, you know, true, and especially in Uzbekistan, we're talking about these, you know, very young population, unemployed, you know, to an extent very angry at their own circumstances, but, you know, social, economic demands have been there. I mean, there are pockets of resistance all the time in Samarkand, in, you know, the east, obviously, Uzbekistan is, you know, is a, people are very much scarred by Andijan, so you don't see a whole lot of there. But, you know, you go west, you go central Uzbekistan, you see these pockets of, you know, people closing down the roads, people doing this and that, you know, just demanding social, economic changes. At some point, those are going to become political. This is, that's the important thing to remember, right? The acceptance for Shavkat Mirziyayev is not going to be as high as Karimov. That I can say for sure. And the price is probably going to be increased, you know, brutality of the state. That increased brutality of the state will definitely flare up tension. And, you know, the one narrative that I'm very wary of and something that, you know, people have been trying to talk up, you know, the terror is going to take over Central Asia because, you know, obviously Muslim-majority countries, so terrorists must be coming. And, well, at least, you know, Karimov and Mirziyayev will keep them, you know, keep them safe from terrorists. You know, their policies will contribute to that. I mean, let's be very, very real. It is for the sake of the of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and I'm not sure about Turkmenistan, honestly, but to an extent, right, all of these countries, you know, that they very much need to open up, whether slowly economically and socially, and then maybe to an extent politically, but it's very important that they do that. And, you know, what Erica's point is absolutely great, that, you know, Nazarbayev is popular, we like it or not. There are circumstances that explain that 100%. But the point is, here's an opportunity to really make a difference by, you know, honest, fair elections through, you know, a vibrant civil society to prevent the very same thing that Eric is talking about, that there's going to be, that there may be violence. And I'd really hope to God that there's no violence, but, you know, at the rate things are going, if they do not really open up and they do not do things, and I'm not pushing the party line here, I do believe that, it is going to be important that they do carry out true reforms to be able to withstand those challenges.
Thank you. I think time is up. We have to end our discussion here. Thank you very much, Bakhtiyor Nishanov, Deputy Director for Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, Erica Meret, Assistant Professor of International Relations at the National Defense University, Dr. Lukan Cesci, Chair of the Central Asian Studies Center at Glasgow University, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Kishlak Uwazi, Central Asia Blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis. Hope to see you in the next Majlis. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.